up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Going look back, Jackson Jacks. I'm Tim Out, Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 18, NASDAQ Futures up 68. Do we have Mr. Flanagan? Do we have Kevin? What do we have here?
You have me. We do not have Mr. Flanagan yet, but hopefully he will be joining us.
He will pile in. You sound pretty good, bud. Not great, yeah, but pretty good.
There are some times when it feels really good just to feel really good. And if you would put the condition I was in last Monday morning, this is one of those times.
There's a lot to be said for Audrey's dad, who made it to 97, used to say, if you have your health, you have everything. If you don't, you got nothing.
Yeah, well, that's probably true.
Yeah, and anyways.
Well, yeah, just the quick version of the whole saga. My little triggering event was that Sunday morning I couldn't so much as swallow a sip of water, and I probably should have gone to the emergency room much earlier than I did, but I didn't go until first thing Monday morning.
So by then, that was manly of you. That was manly of you.
Well, you know, you keep thinking, this isn't going to last. You know, this will be okay. So, you know, having gone a good, you know, 24, maybe a little more hours without so much as swallowing a bit of water, let alone any food or other nutrition, I was in pretty bad shape by Monday morning. So they immediately got me going on IVs. But backing up the train a little bit, I had a really, really sore neck on starting last week Wednesday, you know, to the point where I just couldn't turn. You know, if I were driving, I wasn't able to turn and look and see if there was traffic coming from the left, traffic coming from the right, before I'd make a turn. I just, you know, if I wanted to run over, like, to the store to get something, it was like getting my daughter and saying, come on, you're riding shotgun, and you're going to tell me when it's safe. So you know, that was the early stages of all of it, and apparently I had that was infection induced, and the infection managed to locate itself into the rest of the neck and the esophagus area, and that got all swollen shut, and there we were. So you know, I had they had to IV me antibiotics for the infection and steroids to get the swelling down. But by Wednesday, they started me into clear liquids, and then yesterday, starting to get some other nutrition down. We did one final diagnostic procedure, and then it was okay. Go home.
Here
I am. Here I am sipping a Pepsi to make sure I have the proper amount of caffeine in me, and talking to you.
It is really strange how some these infections. But you didn't have a entry point, did you? I mean, it wasn't like a scratch on your neck or anything like that.
No, it was nothing like that.
I haven't seen him in a while because it's Thursday night's his night at Tripoli. I'm not usually there, but Dr. Billy was telling me one of his friends. The daughter had broken an ankle or something and had some plates in there. And all of a sudden she, I don't know, she messed up her elbow or she did something where there was a scratch and got a staph infection and it went right for the where the plates were in her ankle to where she had to have surgery to clean it out. And if a staph infection goes right to the...
Infections are there to try and eject things. So, yeah, I could see that happening. You know, foreign something foreign there. Let's go attack it.
And, it, you know, and it's... I had staph infection once, and boy, the antibiotics they gave me were... Kevin, this was 35 years ago, and it was $10 a pill. It was disgusting. I mean, not the price, but...
My copay on this little batch of antibiotics that I have to continue for the next week was $2.24, so...
But I'm saying that the antibiotics they give you are not...
A little better off on that. Than that
I'm saying they're they're really strong, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a... I mean, they're not fun. If you had those on for a month, you'd be. If you took those for like 6 weeks, you'd be dead because you can't digest. I mean, they're bad. But
they're waging war.
Yeah.
Anyway, it feels good to feel good again.
Well, good.
We march on. A couple other little nuggets is hospital television really, really sucks. They don't get a lot of. They don't get many good channels. They don't get any. Other than the ESPNs, they don't really get any sports. So I did subscribe to the MLB live stream, and so I was able to watch some baseball. I'm still in the 7-day cancellation period. So I suppose when I go in today to cancel it, they'll probably ask why. Should I say that because the Cubs piss me off?
That would do it.
We can go that route.
You had the Little League World Series to watch.
Yeah, I don't get into that too much. It's it's fun. It's all right. It's good, but it's not baseball at the highest level. The highest level for that age group, but
some of the stuff you look at people and it's kind of at every walk of life, Kevin. Not so obvious, I suppose, but the theme of the show is like everything is connected to everything else. I guess there could be an independent asteroid to hit you on the head, but I was watching a game last night, and so they got this kid on there talking about doing watching what the major leaguers do in the worst way. So the kid, I don't think you did. You never wore any armor in the Little League, on your elbows and stuff. Even though I was,
I don't think we had much of it.
No, I was. Even though I was prone to hit kids, not on purpose, just a little wild. So this kid's got the armor thing on his elbow, and the first guy gets on, and the guy's up there, and the guy throws one. Might have been inside. As a matter of fact, it might have been a strike. So the kid sees it come and nudges the little piece of armor out there, and it gets nicked, absolutely on purpose. So the ump awards him first base. It was his best Barry Bonds, Bobby Bonds thing, Barry Bonds, whatever else. So the manager comes out, like, what the hell? What the hell was that? So all the umpires get together in this big. I think the ball could easily have been called a strike, Kevin. and of course, the umpire is absolutely clueless that that's exactly what the kid did. He's standing right in front of him. It did it on purpose. I mean, and all of a sudden, this big powwow, and they're talking about replays and blah blah blah. And they send the kid to first base, and I'm going, how much more obvious does it have to be before you idiots wake up? I mean, I don't know. It's not up to me to argue about Little League baseball, but I mean, it's the same crap you see everywhere else. Nobody seems to be able to deal with anything in these days. You can't deal with the biker going through the stop sign. You can't deal with the guy in the shoulder of the road going a million. We can't deal with anything. It's crazy. You got a 12-year-old sticking his elbow over the plate and getting nicked, and then you give him first base. What am I ranting about here? Just general or what?
Well, I think it's a good general rant. Yeah. Hey, one more baseball thing. This was from the because I did have the streaming package, so I was watching the Braves and the Brewers, and this came up in there, and it's a pretty good little trivia question for, and it's current. There are 5 current roster Major League Baseball pitchers who have a win against each of the 30 teams in MLB.
How many? You gave me that one. I couldn't. There obviously has to be somebody who's, well, actually, you don't have to pitch in both leagues anymore. I'm guessing that they did, though.
Yeah, he's been around a while. And I'll give you one that'll be really hard to get. And that's because he's been on the IL all season recuperating from surgery, and that's Gerrit Cole of the Yankees.
Okay,
so that's one. But it also gives you an idea of the kind of pitcher that it has to be, the kind of longevity and career that's required to pull that off.
Well, I wouldn't know. I mean, maybe a Kershaw?
No, Kershaw's never beaten the Dodgers, never pitched against the Dodgers.
Well, I can't even... I mean, it's easy, even with
There's one that just jumped right out at me.
You got me on this one.
Justin Verlander.
Okay,
that was the easy one. And then you think about that, and you think, okay, Max Scherzer.
Yeah.
That makes sense, right? Then it gets a little dicier, but Charlie Morton's one of them. Who's got to be, what, like 43? And
well, if you would have said pitched against every team, I would have guessed the reliever, but then they're not going to beat every team.
Yeah, but they haven't beaten every team. So Charlie Morton was one. He's, you know, he's been around forever. He's pitched in the World Series. Kind of the slow one. But the guy who was pitching in the game was the other one at the time, and that's what brought it up, and that's Jose Quintana.
Really?
Yeah. That was the eyebrow raiser to me, and yet... You know, as I think about it, it shouldn't be, because he pitched for the White Sox for a long time, pitched for the Cubs for a long time, and he's been gone from the Cubs for a long time, so he's still been knocking around for teams like the Mets and now the Brewers. That's not a surprise either. So take some longevity. You don't have to be a dominant pitcher like Verlander was, but you have to have been good enough to stay in rotation after rotation after rotation.
Do you think there's anybody who's ever saved with every team?
Or save against every team?
Yeah. Or you earned a save against every team.
I have no doubt that there are some of those, yeah. I'd have to do some research and think about it, but if his team won a game against, and he's the closer, and he won a game against every team, then, you know, or he was a pitcher on a team that has beaten every other team, I'm sure that the save would have been involved in that one.
Do we have Mr. Flanagan? I thought I heard something.
Yes.
Yeah, how are you? This is enough to drive you nuts, but I've been every day now I'm listening to like one or two things of these YouTube podcasts, and I'm trying to get somebody from each side every day to sound how stupid they both sound, but you do end up with a couple of glimmers of facts. And I was listening yesterday to some guy who's already said the crash has already started. I don't think he was talking about the market, but he claims that and I think Florida might be a special case with the insurance and stuff, but he was talking about how Florida, Georgia, and Texas property values are dropping like a rock. I mean, have you heard that? I mean, he of course had some house in Texas that Blackstone had bought for $400,000, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and it went up to $500,000, and it actually was appraised at $640,000. No, they bought it at $500,000. It was appraised at $640,000. Now it's on the market for $399,000, and they don't have any takers. It's like it's a big house, 6 bedrooms. Have you heard anything like that? I mean,
I actually have, and I've heard it on this very show. Now, I haven't heard anything lately where they're saying widespread property value drops. It doesn't surprise me because we had such a boom during all the COVID-19 craziness. But Carl's talked about the Tennessee area where people bought, you know, where they figured, that buying properties for Airbnb purposes was going to be a big-time profitable business. And it probably was for a year or two when nobody wanted to do any conventional travel, but it did not, you know, it wasn't a long-term investment. Things were going to go back to somewhat normal where, people would just travel and go to hotels and things like that. And so he talked about all the people who were stuck with that I would call Airbnb properties that weren't renting anywhere and were kind of worthless. So I'm not surprised to hear that because we were hearing firsthand descriptions a year or two ago from Tennessee.
I thought those guys just were in Tennessee, bought a house, walked into a bar, and saw Carl.
Well, would that drive you away, or would that...
It would drive me to like being there.
For interesting conversation, or would it mean interesting conversation in the bar until you got scared of poor Carl?
I'd say I would love it, but then again, that makes me very unusual.
Yes, just you are.
I
heard, you know, Austin in particular had been out of his life for about a year, but the values had really slipped, and it was picking up speed, and selected cities in Florida, too. So yeah, you know, around Chicago, we didn't have quite the run up that other places had going back to 2007, 2008. So it hasn't been as visible here, I don't think. But I have heard that, you know, the real estate prices have really started to collapse in some places.
Yeah, I would say that for a while, when the houses ran up 10 years ago, wasn't Texas one of the places where they didn't run up, so they didn't run down in the last, like, 2007, 2008? They were one of the places that didn't have the problem because they never ran up in the first place.
Well, and part of that was that there were so many jobs lost in other parts of the country. And then we had, following 2007 and all, we had the oil drilling boom. So there was a lot of need for housing as people flocked out of their locales and moved to places like Texas, South Dakota, and North Dakota, and so on. So that would explain a little, that's my hypothesis anyway, of why they may not have been hurt so much. Because there was demand for housing, North Dakota, they just couldn't keep up. They were having a hell of a time trying to find places, and they had mobile home ghettos popping up like crazy, just to try and accommodate the number of people who were moving there. Now that all got stabilized and then some. So you probably did have Texas where it wasn't as affected at the time, but now it would be because things just got sorted themselves out in terms of covering for oil-related employment. Well, now, again, that's just me, conjuring up an explanation that would have to be proven. So you could see that, and then as part of the madness, there were a lot of people that said, "Well, I can't live in the city if I can't go anywhere or do anything." So I want the space, I want the yard, I want I want to be able to put my kids out in the yard, whatever, to go play. And so we drove up prices like crazy.
Yeah.
On that, and that can't be sustainable forever. So, sooner or later, those houses are going to want to roll over into whatever's next for a family. And, if they all got bought in the same 18-month period, they're probably a disproportionate amount of them are going to want to go back on the market in a similar 18-month period if buying and reselling habits repeat themselves. And so now you have a market that's somewhat flooded, and that's not holding itself up.
Yeah, the thing that's got me kind of weirded out about this, and weirded out is actually the correct term, is that I've been... I'm sort of the voice, and Carl's with me on this. We talk about it more than maybe the other guests, a little bit Russell, about why the worldwide push now is to put more money into the system and inflate the economy. Well, one of the reasons why you do that is and without getting personal on the president, it absolutely benefits the businesses that he's in. But let's leave that aside. The fact is, it benefits government huge inflationary pressure. They have to pay people back in money that's worth less. The tax rates go up as people get raises and go into different brackets. And oh, by the way, when the car you buy at 80 grand instead of 60 grand, the sales tax on it, the federal government doesn't get that. Sales tax on that is 30% higher, right? So, duh. And you're seeing this, it's choreographed worldwide, and it really started in somewhere in 2023, but it wasn't just the Biden group. It was Europe, it was Japan, it was everybody. It was almost like there was a double secret meeting somewhere, and whoever really is in charge decided to do it. And I've been noticing it going up in the money supply here, even though, you know, the CPI people fight all day long. Are prices going up or are they going down? Simple fact is the money supply is going up, and those prices are going up. I don't care who the hell you are, and I don't care if it's new monetary theory, whatever it is. But the thing of it is, I just look at the monthly, which is now in arrears, and, you know, I've been stumbling along going, man, it looks like last month was a 5.3% annual rate. It was 5.5. Well, then last month was 7.4 or whatever. Now, Hal, who's way better at math and has the capability of doing this better than me, you actually can get the weeklies. I don't know if you guys knew that. If you go back like a month. So if you want to get like the last month that's out there, we're in August. The last month you can get is June, right? Which is pretty screwed up. But if you actually, there's another site, Fed site, where you can get all the weeks up until June too. Okay, which I don't look at. I just look at the monthly because it's so far back. Well, Hal evidently went back and did all the weeklies leading up to June. For I don't know how far back he went. If you look at the little nudge-ups in the weeklies, instead of me just doing the monthly, you know, basically by the seat of my ass, he put it all together in some kind of mathematical formula, and it looks horrible. It looks like the year is going to be 9.7, and next year is going to be, what, like 11 point something? And that's something out of World War II, out of the Civil War, out of late 70s, which caused a huge problem and a huge mess in the whole. We're talking serious stuff. And you know, I look at that and I'm going, here I'm saying this is bad. Hell, you had to tell me it's like twice as bad as I thought it was. I mean, what do you guys say? I mean, what? And so it can either collapse like the 70s did, and all of a sudden you've got long-term rates where people say, hey, I'm not giving anybody any money for less than 10 or 12% for 10 years. I guess we could go all the way to the Weimar Republic when you went all the way to the end and the whole thing blew up. Hope we don't do that. What do you guys think the end game of this is? I'm not saying it's all Trump. I'm not saying anything. I'm saying, but what is the end game of this other than it's good for the government for a while?
Did you read the copy of the Great Reset that I sent you? Did you ever read that?
Part of it. I'm gaining.
Because that was... You know, that's basically the World Economic Forum playbook, and they said exactly what we're going to do, and this is part of it.
But where does it ever come to a good end? I mean, where did it ever end well? It sure as hell didn't for Germany. They ended up a little dude with a mustache.
They won't, but the whole idea is that they're just sorting out how they want society organized and run, where they want the power. Who's behind that? Well, that's a lot of government people that are involved in the World Economic Forum, but it's also just a lot of rich people. You're always talking, you know, you raise this and you're right. Yeah. You know, who's the person behind the curtain? Well, these are people behind the curtain.
Well, how come they've got to be the same people that used Epstein to get goods on people? I mean, there's got to be the same group all over.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah. But, you know, they're not hiding it. They're, you know, they're pretty open about it.
Except for the part where who's the they. That's the part that's a little hidden.
Go look at your roster of who's attending. Well, when they get together at Davos, they, you know, who's there? Who's there and what role are they playing? What are they presenting? What are they doing? You know, there's people like Gates who are very prominent in that whole movement. But there's a lot more, and there's a lot... You know, I mean, there's a lot of really, really rich, influential people who don't spend the time in the limelight that someone like Gates does. They stay a little below the radar and still are pulling a lot of strings.
Well, I would submit this.
There's all the obvious players too, all the people that you know.
Well, I don't. It's a thing. None of us do know. We suspect, but we don't know who's actually using their position to. I don't see Bill Gates with the capability of getting Japan, U.S., Euro, and Brit together and say, you're all going to start the money supply up this month. I don't see him with anywhere near that power. The question is, who the hell does? And whoever it is, I will bet, is not...
It's not one individual, though. It's a group of people. They all get together, they agree on what the plan's going to be, and then they execute.
If there is such a group, and I'm not saying there isn't, I'll bet there's the furthest thing from right or left, and the man in the moon. It's all them.
I agree.
I mean, how do you... If
I agree. and you can look at, you know, what policies push it. Well, you know, we saw inexplicable, other than for power move, inexplicable policies during COVID-19, things that just made no sense other than to control, almost as if that was just the big op to see what we could make people do. And then, not even almost as, it was. And then you want to pile on top of that, use climate change. We could have arguments. I could have people who say, hey, you're, of course, we like the term denier because that's, it's so pejorative, but you can say, you're denying it and science is proving it otherwise. Okay, let's go with that for a minute. How many trillions of dollars have we spent trying to remediate climate change just in the last 10 years or 20 years? You know, how much money have we spent? Because all of this money that we spend is really aimed at controlling behavior of large groups of people. But have we done a damn thing to alter the climate? And or are we still claiming that we're on... that we're facing doomsday? And the answer is, everybody says we're still facing doomsday. Well, if we've spent that much money doing remediation, and it's changing people's behavior, and it's changing the products they can buy, and it's changing what they're allowed to do, and they're putting restrictions on people, and still talking about maybe we need nobody to be able to own cars and everything's done, transportation is done collectively, all those kinds of things. If that's where we are, then we have wasted all of those dollars because we haven't changed it.
Well, I'm going to say, Kevin, if there's...
People aren't that stupid to keep spending trillions and trillions of dollars not making any progress. They'd be doing something different unless the whole point is really to just control people's behavior.
I would say that some of that money, and by the way, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying some of that money, it's not. It sort of has the guise of fighting or environmental stuff. But if you look here in the Chicago area, the three coal plants that came down, Commonwealth Edison refused to pony up the money to clean them up. And they're all in residential communities that they probably weren't when they were built, but they sure as hell are now. And I don't, there's a blend there. I don't know that that's all, you can blame that all on the climate change creatures. I think that was done because the things were dirty and they refused to clean them. So there's a blend to the cash here, is what I'm saying, Kevin. I'm not disagreeing with you, but some of the stuff that they tout on climate change really is pollution control. Some of it. I mean,
right, and I don't think there's anybody out. There aren't people out there in the world, or at least, other than Montgomery Burns, real life Montgomery Burns people who are just going to say, "Well, screw it, pollution. Who cares?" Everybody cares about that. Nobody wants dirty air. Nobody wants dirty water. Any of that kind of stuff. So there's consensus there. But the real consensus, the real place where there's not consensus, but there is behavior that will, change societies if unchecked, is what are we doing to address climate change? And if the answer is we're not doing anything effectively, then what's the other explanation for very, very well educated, very wealthy people? What would other explanation would there be for them to continue down the path we're on?
Why would
that says you really have to think about what people's motivations are here.
Well, I would say that as you know, always close to my heart is the rail system. I could envision if you gave me some dough and some people that know more about design and stuff, I could envision a Chicago with 5, 6, 10 really innovative streetcar lines that were not beholden to traffic, that had segregated right away, that went right through neighborhoods and brought people safely and swiftly from place to place, where they didn't have to fight traffic and honk at people and have people flip their finger at them. I wouldn't say it was climate change. I would just say a betterment. If you did it properly, I guess it would help climate change. I mean, hell knows. If that's the you know, if that's the battering ram I have to do to get funding, but I just think it would make things better. I mean, I wouldn't call it climate change, but I'd like to see it.
But we're talking on two different levels here. I'm talking about the things where they start talking about what you're allowed to own.
Oh, I agree. I mean, the idea you can't have a gas lawnmower or that kind of, I mean,
it's one thing to control behavior. It's another thing to want to say, I want to create efficient means of transportation. And I don't mind creating eco-friendly means of transportation. But, you know, we had the big push for electronic vehicles, where if you look through the whole model of it and how the whole supply chain's end to end is, it's not saving us anything on carbon footprint or anything like that.
If you look at both sides here, I mean, and what we're talking about is kind of non-denominational, but if you look at both sides seem to have read Hitler's a definition of the big lie in Mein Kampf. Both sides use it. I've talked to people that are absolutely convinced that electric cars are the cat's ass, and yet I think all of us know if you take it from some stem to stern, it's probably worse than a gas car. I mean, or not much better.
And yet I don't have a problem with people who like the technology and think the electric car vehicle is cool. Go ahead, knock yourself out, get one.
I have a real problem. I'm going to ask you guys a question regarding these where this is going. Do you think this all started with the Patriot Act? How much we can do to people in because we had a crisis there?
Certainly a factor. Where it started and how that fits in history would require a little bit of thought.
I have a
just let me jump back on EVs for a minute because
that's where I was going too. I don't want. How come they don't pay any taxes?
Yeah, because that's exactly. You and I are going the same place on that. Now I don't have to pay road taxes because we collect road taxes via gasoline tax. So how are we going to have to address that? Well, we're going to have to address that by putting a tax on mileage instead. And how are we going to do that? Well, if we're going to tax mileage, then we have to be able to track it. So that means we have to, have that tracking automatically report. Where you go, when you've been there, how much mileage you've driven, so that we can properly assess that tax. And so, oh good, we have that now. I know everywhere. This is just like the toll road stuff that if they don't clean it up and delete it. So now we have we know exactly where you've been, how long you've been there. Well, gee, if we want to say. To prevent climate change, we're going to clamp limits on you about how much you can travel. You're well positioned to do that now.
I would go with something. I'm a much more simple guy.
The way EVs work, we can just shut you down right in line.
As soon as you
get home, afterwards, you may have exceeded your limit by a few miles, but you ain't going to be able to start your car tomorrow morning
why can't we do something simple? Since the thing's way more than regular cars anyway. The average person drives, let's say, 20,000 miles a year. The average car probably gets 20 miles at a gallon. All right, so you're 1,000 gallons of gas, and the tax here in Illinois is roughly $1, 93 cents or something. How about $900 a year, guys? That's what it costs to run an electric car. I don't want to be invasive into where you're going and what you're doing. It's $900.
No, but I do time because you might drive yours twice as much as mine, and that's not. You would not be paying your fair share.
I'll stick with the simple.
Yeah, I know. I get it. I hear what you're saying, but you can read and hear those discussions. They're out in the open.
Oh, I know. Oh, yeah.
Get a lot of publicity, but you can do that. And so now, if we say we really want you in public transportation, you exceed your quota on private. Because remember, your gas. If we're switching over to a mileage tax, your gas powered vehicle is going to have to report in too.
Said I don't want to go down that road. I'll be happy with 500.
Now we can say, okay, you used up your allotment. You have 5 days left this month. You better have public transportation plans. So I'm painting scenarios. These may be a long way from implementation. They may never happen. But you have people out there people with influence out there thinking like this and writing op-eds like this.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt.
This is what's going on, and John hasn't jumped in on this. John, you should weigh in on this.
You know what John was doing? John's putting together a firm to come up with the machine that does your mileage so he can sell it to the state.
He's not a stupid man.
No, it's again. Go ahead, John.
I'm working on a census. You'll be able to activate your census data just by having a chip in you, so they'll know all about you before somebody rings the doorbell or sends you something in the mail. But what you were saying about the Patriot Act, Tom, I absolutely agree with. You pick an amorphous enemy, and one that you can never quite identify, but it's always there. You have to fear it, and you've got a role in stopping it. So that worked pretty well. Then you have the climate. Then you have DEI. You're a racist whether you know it or not, and you got to fight this. And to do that, you're going to have to control yourself and take a really long, hard look at your consumption patterns and the way you think about the world and realize how unimportant you are in all of this. And to a great extent, all of these campaigns have succeeded in making people feel like they have no reason to live, or they're taking up too much space, or they're keeping somebody else from exercising the same freedoms as some other group of people that you deep down must really despise. So they've got people by the throat because they can guilt trip them into almost anything, changing their consumption patterns or changing the way they view themselves as creatures. So it's been very successful.
And
it's a lot of that is we talk about the schools and education and why isn't education addressing any of this? A lot of the way curriculum gets designed, especially at the primary grade levels, is specifically to say we are going to train you in, to be DEI warriors, to be climate change warriors. Yeah, if we get to the math, science, and in English, that's important too. But all of a sudden, the rest of this stuff becomes part and parcel to the educational goals too, as well to the learning objectives, and it's there. It's really there, and a lot, sort of the backfire of all of it during the lockdowns was that a lot of parents got insight into this that did not have it before, and so that has caused a fair amount of pushback. And when you talk about MAGA movement, that's a certain amount of what's behind people being so receptive to it, because they had a front and center look at what their kids were being taught, and during that time, kids were encouraged, no, you should be in your room with the door closed, so that really, because we don't want your parents coming in and seeing what we're doing here.
Yeah. Well, at some point,
that was very eye opening for a lot of.
I would agree. I had actually a lot of when Audrey's cousin was still alive, we'd go to his place, and a lot of the people in the hood from his area, he was in the Lamont area. He was a big entertainer kind of guy, so guys would come over and talk to people.
I hear Lamont, I just think Fred Sanford going, Lamont, you big dummy.
Oh yeah, but I got to meet a lot of people I wouldn't normally bump into, type of thing, and. Just whenever you go outside your little area of people, you meet different people and you learn from them if you want, or you can argue with them. They were pretty shocked at some of the stuff. They were shocked not only at some of this, Kevin, but they were shocked at how horrible the math teaching and the other stuff was. Nobody could. I still stumble over this one. What's my nephew's wife to me? Is she my niece-in-law or something? I don't know. Anyway,
nephew, wife, I would call her a niece.
But she's she teaches math in one of the near south suburban things, and she goes, firstly during COVID, she goes, nobody knows any math. We decided to sacrifice geometry to COVID. She goes, that's crazy, because everybody who, if you ever put a deck together in your backyard, you should know a little bit about geometry, so you know what the guy's talking about. She goes, you can't just sacrifice a year of math. And then when they don't know anything, instead of flunking them, they have a two-day seminar to try and make up for the whole year, and they still don't know anything, and they pass them anyway. I don't understand where we're heading with this.
And you know what? That generation, it's part of the political shift that you saw, where the amount of young people that moved over to, moved away from the Democrats for sure, whether they fully embraced you know, the Republican side. And I don't even know. I don't even know that I would call Trump and his movement Republican either, because that I don't think that's accurate. But who moved that way? One is they did start to see, and you've mentioned YouTube and doing a lot of podcasts. They did start to see not just Trump, but other other politicians similar. J.D. Vance's sit down with Rogan was great. Where there's just long conversations, lots of follow-up, and they're finding out that the people that in mainstream media they're calling Hitler and threats to democracy and all of that, were really like pretty normal people if you sit them down for 2 hours or 3 hours.
I don't want to fight about that, but
well, I know you don't because you won't go listen to them. So
Kevin, I don't
listen
after yesterday. I sent the thing around when the man jumps out there and says money is flowing in from other countries on the tariff. That is a fat-ass lie. And it's coming from our president. Nobody overseas is paying our tariff. And yet 40% of the morons in this country believe it because it's the big lie. I mean, maybe...
And we can come back to that, but that's a different topic.
What I'm saying is if he said...
We were talking about the younger people, and all I'm saying is they are shifting away because they had those teen years taken away from them, and a lot of them now are figuring out that they're very pissed about that. These are the same kind of people where we have people who don't want to go, they don't want to go back to the office. They like remote working. These are the people who are going and saying, I want to go to an office. I want a social place to be.
I agree.
And that's showing up. That's a lot of, it's all pushback from that. And that's part of the backfire, too. But you still have a really, really strong amount of influence in other areas that are really, they're not educational influence, they're culture shift influence.
Kevin, I think what I'm seeing is maybe a little different, and because you're part of the solution there. I mean, what you're seeing, the people who you deal with, and you deal with everybody. So I'm not putting you in a closet here. You deal with everybody, but you're looking at somebody who's got the X job. All of a sudden, they want to better themselves. They're willing to come to school, spend time, get the X plus job, even though it may not still be the world's greatest job. But a year later, they come and do something else. And now it's the X plus plus job. You're dealing with, again, it's a gross generalization. You're dealing with a lot of people that are somehow able and willing to move up the chain. The younger people that I come across, I mean, here are sort of in a business that is, other than me managing money for people, and people still have a lot of money in stocks, and by the way, it's very important to them. So I love my job. But in terms of people learning what I know, I mean, if the young people I talk to, every single degreed person here, whether it was a COVID or whatever, is in a dead-ass regulatory job. There's no life here. There's no. They're never going to be a trader. They're never going to be on a trading floor where they can make a mistake. They can talk to people. It's a whole different world. Your world is much more vibrant than the world I see. I mean,
parts of it. Yeah, I think that, I do think the world of the people who work in manufacturing and they go in every day, that people, distribution, all those kinds of things, they do live a very, very different world than what we would normally call the professional tracks for employment. And it's a good thing. They're more real. They sort of get living it every day. As far as young people coming in, because I do deal with a lot of, as you say, a lot of working adults, but as far as young people coming in, they're a little bit interesting group of people. It varies from I probably start categorizing them, and I don't like to spend a lot of time categorizing people. But we have a very large Hispanic population in Elkhart County. Some of it I know isn't legal, and some of it is, but a lot of it is legal. But
it's also very vibrant.
It's vibrant. They're very entrepreneurial because, if we'll put it this way, if you're not documented, you better find a way to make a living that doesn't require you.
But there isn't a lazy bone in the neighborhood.
Huh?
There isn't a lazy bone in the neighborhood.
Well, and that's sort of my point. I get it's the families are tight, and that's the big deal there. Is it, you know, education? They're first generation college students, and I have, you know, they're not all Spanish speakers who are first generation college students, but a lot of the first generation people, it's a big family affair. It's a big deal, and there's a lot of support for them, and they're wonderful students. And I have to deal with language barriers and things like that, and it's not hard. You know, it's not hard. My job is to educate.
Hey, people. Can I ask you?
Let me finish the thought on. So that's that. But I still, you know, we still get the people who will come out of high school. They weren't particularly good students. Some of them will catch fire and do very well. But some of them they show up for a while because their parents told them they have to do something. You know, have to do something else, anything else.
Get off the sofa.
And they tend not to be very good students because they're not there on their own volition. They're pushed. I still have those same educational challenges where they're not well prepared by the school system. They're not highly motivated because I can make a lot of time. I can teach people some, you know, the remedial math stuff. I can give them some really good English basics where they're, you know, I'm not making them into great students or fantastic students, but I'm making them into people who can function in the work world. But they have to be motivated to do it. And so I run into those same problems that your high school teachers are going to run into as well.
Do you find, maybe we shouldn't even answer or answer this one, but do you notice that one of the issues in a lot of the Hispanic communities that I come across, they're not as anxious for the girls to do well in school as the guys, which I think was the same thing with my Italian relatives years ago.
Nothing I've ever noticed.
I've heard that. I was hoping it wasn't
really,
true.
Really, some of my notes. Heck, I've had students, you know, how they typically have valedictorian speeches at graduation. The way we do it is it's the distinguished graduate. So you have to have the really good grades, but it's really an all-around type of thing. And I was moderator of a leadership group, and I've done a lot of things like that. And I've had two of my Spanish-speaking leadership students have been the distinguished graduate.
You know what's kind of weird, Kevin?
And not only that, one of them is now one of our trustees. You know, she graduated several years ago, and now she's one of the trustees for our area.
I'm going to lob one out.
I see very high achieving Spanish speaking women.
I'm going to lob one out there for that Audrey notices kind of as well, because she, you know, dealing with families all the time. So the younger people now, she thinks that generation is going to be more like us. And
I think so too.
And some of the people that you know, like I said, pile around our table on a Thursday night, the guys that are 25, they don't want to talk to the people that are 40. That they talk to, well, they view them as just a bunch of bureaucrats. They want to sit down and talk to me, of all people. God, what was it like to do this on your own? What can I do something like that? Something. It's a whole different. There's some entrepreneurial curiosity there. I don't want to just do this. You mean you just never had a job like this? You were always doing something on your own. How can I do that? There is a curiosity in this group that I find. Now, of course, I don't talk to everybody, but there is a little bit more of a curiosity that. They're not going to be as happy being the cubicle person, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. Other than the need for the interaction, I think they're, you know, that people are looking for really good social outlets, and they're looking for it partly in terms of work. It's not, you know, it's the youngest people. It's the people who were in high school 4 years ago.
Well, some of the people that I say, how come you don't go to work? They'd say, I'd love to go to work, but there's nobody there.
Yeah, and so you're finding a lot, you know, a lot of pushback to that, and you know, one way to get around that is start your own business and have your own social environment.
Well, what do you do, Kevin, when you see stuff that, and I'm like, you know, politically, whether it was COVID, whether you know it's a threat, whatever it is, we're starting to see a lot of, again, I have a small world here because I talked to my nephew and some people from the South Side, and they're. A lot of them are in the metalworking things, which are Southside used to be loaded with these places. And of course, 80% of them are closed, and a few that are left were hanging, you know, hanging by a thread, and now they're doing a little better, and there's been a little bit of expansion, and there's actually some interest in buying a couple from people I know. And all of a sudden, last week, I you know, talked to a couple of these guys, and they're going, wait a minute. The last 6 weeks, whatever's happened, I don't know enough to blame it on tariffs or whatever, everybody's just hit a wall. All of a sudden, we're not working Saturdays, we're not doing this, the phone's not ringing. The people we usually supply parts to on an emergency basis because their machine broke down and need it tomorrow, they're not working as hard, so the machine's not breaking as often. What the hell just happened?
We talk about total preventative maintenance programs. Yeah, just don't work as much.
Well,
that's not how you're supposed to be doing it.
Well, one of their customers, a lot of people have them as their customer because they're huge, is Tootsie Roll. You know, and Tootsie Rolls, a lot of these machines are 50 years old. They're all made in Germany. They're spectacular, and if something, they have the stuff they know they have to replace every 2 and 3 years. But they also have something that happens. You know, it could be a conveyor, it could be something. And there's people that jump to it and make those parts for those guys like on a weekend. And, you know, they're really good at this stuff. And they got the old kind of lathes and whatever you want, they can make. I mean, it's, you know, our people are pretty friggin' inventive.
There's people who are responsive, but... You know, and we've had this part of the conversation before too. If you look at how things are changing right now, and let's not debate whether that's good, bad, what's really happening, what's not, but you're saying I'm going to have this cost inflicted on me, and I don't get a vote on that. Well, who's going to thrive? Because as I say constantly, you can't just put that into your pricing and say that'll cover it. You can't do that because that's not how pricing works. Pricing works based on what customers are willing to pay for something. And just because your cost went up doesn't mean I'm willing to pay more for it. So if you can successfully right now take extra costs and pass it on to your customers, and your customers are going to continue to pay it, that just tells me you've been stupid all along because you could have been charging that all along.
Not really. But go ahead.
That is absolutely true.
It depends on how necessary the thing is.
Okay, we can play that, but so I will grant that element is part of it, but there aren't that many things that are that necessary. So now what I'm really saying is, okay, who's going to be able to absorb this? And it's the companies that are that really understand, you know, the lean principles, that they've been part of that movement all along, that they are operating, that they're not scrapping a lot of stuff. They don't have, you know, they've been systematically taking inefficiencies out of their processes, you know, and then there are others who are just now realizing they have to get started. There's a lot behind the curve, and those are going to be my customers over the next several years, by the way. And I'm working right now on really hard marketing some of the quality stuff. My point being, if I can go take 15% cost out of my out of my process, if I'm scrapping 5% of the stuff that comes down my production line, because of flaws, basically. If I'm doing that, then I'm running a really, really crappy, overly expensive process. And if I take that 5% and I cut it to 2%, that's still not good. And yet, what that will do for my cost structure is amazing. So, you know, you just start doing the math on this stuff, and it makes all kinds of sense, and it's made all kinds of sense all along. But as is typical, you get up and running, you have a certain amount of success in a business, it's real easy to be sloppy as you go, and that sloppiness will, sooner or later, it's going to come back and bite you in the ass. But for the time being, you're kind of flush, and so you don't worry too much about it. So what I'm saying is that's a big part of what the business world is, part of the awakening in the business world. And, you know, I don't even remember how I got going down this road.
But it's to a point. I mean, we would have dueling blackboards if we were in class together.
Yeah, but I would win that one.
No, you wouldn't.
Every time.
No, you wouldn't.
Because I spend my life doing it now.
The reason why you wouldn't is because a lot of the stuff that people make or assemble or whatever term you want to do, they're getting the parts from other people. So if you, I'll use the rail car example, 60% of the car was bought from somebody else. And if all those prices went up, you could go from 2,000 hours a car, and the best rail car assembler in the world maybe could go to 1,900. But you're talking about a 5% improvement on 30% of the cost of the item. So I mean, if you're selling gasoline and the price of gasoline goes up, you can not have somebody put it in somebody's tank. You can do whatever you want. You can have the most efficient station. The fact is, if you're buying the gas at $5, you got to sell it for more than $5. And it's not up to you. So it depends on like each and every product. You're right. If you're doing the whole thing, the guy who can actually save 15% of the total cost is going to absolutely win out. I'll never debate you on that. But if your value added is only 10% to start with, 15% of that is damn near nothing.
I understand, but at the same time, if I'm buying a product from, you know, pick a country, I'm buying product from Malaysia, I might be, you know, I might have a really good supplier and I'm very, very happy with it. But if I'm getting too much crap, and so, you know, what do I have to do? Well, I might not wind up paying for the crap. I might back bill, I might do all those kinds of things, but it also means I have to order more, because the time lag for getting parts ordered from Malaysia to meet my market demand, which might be seasonal or it might be something else, that time lag is so big. So now I have to account, you know, for extra inventory. Carrying inventory is expensive. It takes up space. It ties up capital. All those kinds of things. And so now if I start to say, let me look again at sourcing in the U.S. where I have shorter order to delivery cycles and a higher level of quality, and it's going to cost me a little more. Now you start asking the question, is it really costing me more?
I don't disagree.
Less, because I'm not dealing with all this bullshit. And so that's, you know, that's a big factor. And this is, you know, this is some of what is just now starting to happen. Whether it's Trump's brilliant plan to reshape manufacturing in the United States, or whether it's just a byproduct of what we're doing and doing things that may or may not make any sense is not anywhere close to my point. My point is just simply that things are changing and some companies are in way better position to adapt, and they're the ones who are going to be thriving over the next few years, and others are going to fall by the wayside because they can't.
Or we could be in a massive recession. Let's hope we don't go there.
And that could induce a huge recession, and I have no idea how all this is going to shake out. How many times have we talked about saying, well, we can't sustain this spending, and there's only a couple of ways, and boy, it sure would be nice to be able to grow out of it, but you know, I don't think we can grow that fast, but that does look like the plan, you know.
So. Well, so what we did is we put a massive tax in on some people, and you gave other people a tax break.
Well, yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, there's a lot to criticize here. So that's why I said I don't want to get into that conversation. I'll leave you.
Well, the one thing we're not going to criticize is the fact that you're back.
Yep.
That's a good news.
That is news of the day.
That is the good news. John, what do you think? Even though he does nothing but fight with me, I love him. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a show without you, Kimmel.
I fight with a smile.
God. Anyway, keep feeling better, buddy. John, you want to hang out a little bit with Carl, or you want to listen in? What are you doing?
I can hang around for about 15, 20 minutes. I want to hear Carl.
All right, Carl, why don't you pile in, bud?
So I have I had a comment, but I put up a little thing in the chat. It's cool. We'll do it now. Did you see the thing that came out of AT&T's chair?
No. We're going to fire him too, like Intel?
Oh, no. This was, all right, so, you know, you guys were talking about the, you know, the shift, if you will, from an employee employment, you know, kind of the, And I've talked a lot about this over the years, the way that employers have, for all intents and purposes, destroyed any hint of any sort of loyalty from their staff. All right. And it, part of the problem that comes out of this is not not as simple as a lot of people would like to think it is, because it started at some of the lower levels, and therefore it got inculcated into people that were getting their first jobs. Okay, to give you an example, and it goes back to when the Obamacare crap started. All right, you had people that were at that time coming of age, entering the workforce. My daughter being one of them. Right, she's working, you know, the usual kind of entry level hourly wage job that you work when you start out, like everybody else, right? Like I did.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Obamacare comes in and says, if you employ people for more than 32 hours a week, you have to offer them health insurance or you're going to get fined. And it has to be paid for by you, the employer. You cannot take it out of their check. And it's mandatory.
Well, it's also tax deductible for you, not for them, which is more nuts.
Okay, I get all that. However, what this did, the employer's reaction to this, instead of saying, up yours, okay, or even better, cut that crap out or face the gallows, because we're just going to shut down. And by the way, now there's, you know, no store, there's no gas station, there's no, you know, there's no whatever. No. What they all did was they said, okay, well, guess what? You're an hourly employee, but because you're an hourly employee, and because, you know, all the other line level people at this place are hourly employees, one of those people might call out sick. And if they do, we can't close the doors and not be open. So we're not cutting you off at 32 hours, we're cutting you off at 25. Because I have to be able to call you in for that shift and not violate this, you know, this constraint. And it, because I'm not paying these fines. Up yours on that to the government, all right? Well, all right, so now you end up with situations like what happened where I used to live down in Northwest Florida. A decent percentage of those jobs were across the, I mean, well, and you have the same thing with the Skyway.
You know what a normal shift is now at Canes? 5 hours.
Right, and you know why that happened? That.
Well, they also don't want to give anybody any overtime. They want to weasel away as best they can.
Well, Chief, I get this, okay? But you had a situation there where, you know, my daughter's, you know, working a retail job, okay? And her an hour of her wages every day goes into just paying the bridge toll to get to and from work.
Yeah. Got help. Well, okay. Hope she doesn't have to pay parking.
Well, I mean, just looking at this from an economics point of view, you know, she's like, F that crap. Well, duh, right? All right. Then you have on top of that, you have what the AT&T guy just came out and said, basically, do your job, work harder. By the way, there's no loyalty. If anything goes wrong, you're out, even though it didn't have anything to do with you. All right. Tough crap. Get out. Goodbye. We're not making any kind of attempt to do anything. All right. And all right. Fine.
At least he admits it.
Well, okay. So he finally admits it. And by the way, he didn't just admit it. He put this in writing. All right. Stanky set this out in writing. And basically,
how do you think these people get these jobs, Carl? Where do they find these people?
Do you know what prompted this?
Make friends and influence people? They must have missed that class. Good Lord!
Chief, you know what started this was that it, you know, he apparently sent around an employee engagement survey, all right, and didn't like the comments that he got back. All right, basically, you suck.
Yeah.
Okay, this place to work sucks. Okay, and rather than saying, the people that work here all think that I suck, and the people that work here all think that this place to work sucks, maybe something here ought to, that could be kind of a problem for retention and talent.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but rather than like, look, I used to have to deal with this, okay, because I sat in the left seat behind the big desk in the corner office, and there were times that, I had people making demands that I considered to be completely unreasonable, and I'd be like, the answer to that's no, all right, but the thing is, here is a CEO of a 140-year-old company that's absolutely enormous, all right? And furthermore, at one time, AT&T was the company that you went to work for, stringing phone wires on poles for people, right? And maintaining that stuff.
My uncle worked at Western Electric for years and years and years.
Yeah, and I mean, this was the deal, was that, and the thing is, though, is there was a... It wasn't a hard contract, but it was a psychological thing. You had a bond with the place that you worked for.
Pullman had three generation people working there.
Well, yeah, but you know what? This whole kind of thing it's eroded over time, and that's absolutely true. All right, and in my industry, when I was doing this stuff, we were in move fast, get stuff done. Okay, now, Zuckerberg perverted that into move fast and break things. No, you left the, throwing China around in the kitchen is not ever a good thing, all right? Oh, by the way, neither is this so-called vibe programming crap. You just saw this thing happen with T, this app that went viral that was for women to bitch about the guys that they'd gone out with. And apparently,
I bet they go out with some clunkers. There probably is some truth.
Well,
to that.
There's plenty of clunkers on all sides. Yep. Okay, when it comes to this, but the thing is, these guys, the guys that developed this thing, apparently paid exactly zero attention to this thing called security, and all of a sudden, all the data, including people, and by the way, because these guys were trying to be exclusive, you got to be a woman, we got to prove it. They had them upload copies of the driver's licenses.
Oh, God.
So now all of a sudden, now we're not just talking about like someone's, ragging about John that they went out on a date with and, he was an asshole in the restaurant or whatever. No. Now we got your identity, including your driver's license number and your home address. And all this stuff gets out there. And it's like, and what is the response? Oh, too bad, so sad.
Excuse me? It's crazy. I don't know what.
Here's the thing. Starkey sticks this out there and basically says there is, lifetime job security and pensions, those have been gone for a long time.
I think, but now the further you get away, Carl, from these people, even knowing the people that work for them, it's fairly expected.
The thing that I see with this is, and there's still folks out there saying, AI is actually going to make things, the impact for people who are there is going to be larger because it's good, you're going to fire half your white collar staff and things like this. And I will reiterate what I've said 100 times before, and I've yet to see anything that dissuades me from this point of view. Even though Google forced me to take the article where I pointed all this stuff down in the advertising side. Because, Google doesn't do anything like that. I have an Android phone, right? My daughter has an Android phone. There's basically two brands, right? You either like Android or you like Apple stuff, right? So there's two, even though there's, 15 different companies that make Android phones, they all run the same operating system, they all look and operate essentially the same. That code, I've ported that software many years ago because the company that made the phone refused to provide any updates and I wanted a newer version. Well, the Android code base is public, which means you can sit there, you can bring it down on your computer, compile it, and make modifications.
Let's put it this way, you could.
Well, yeah, you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. But so I've done this, but that means, and I've also, I have my home control software, which means I write software that runs on it as well. All right, I've done that also, but that means I've dug into the internals of this stuff. What Google has managed to monetize and become a dominant player in is best described by me as the output of 1,000 monkeys with typewriters trying to type up a sonnet. All right. To coin an old phrase, right? If you put enough monkeys in front of typewriters, eventually you'll get a sonnet. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
What it really is a unbelievable, stupid effing mess, which is why every month there's 4 more security problems that are found within there. And if you don't keep current with your patches, you're asking to have all your data stolen. And by the way, Windows is the same way. All right, Patch Tuesday is a thing for a reason. Here's the problem. If AI is so good at writing software, why isn't Google, who has more money than God, taken their AI and said, here is the Android software base, rewrite it so it actually works and doesn't suck?
Because AI is not that good. You've been saying that for years.
Well, because AI doesn't do any of that shit.
Right.
Okay? AI really isn't capable of any of the things that people say it is. Because if it was, a company that has more money than God would
Carl,
have
Carl,
taken...
We're living in the world of the big lie and everything.
I
Democrat,
understand.
Republican, in the middle, whatever it is, people say, whatever they feel, and other idiots believe them.
Yeah, but you know what, Chief? This particular big lie is not only creating dislocations in various places, it's chewing up a shit ton of electrical power.
Yeah, well,
for absolutely no purpose. And by the way, it's also chewing up a shit ton of water in places that are short of it.
Yeah, well,
like Texas.
Yeah, Bill was. Did you enjoy Bill's stuff the other day?
What I find amusing about that is that I had, when I was much younger, I had a uncle he's dead now, which is really sad. But hey, it happens to all of us eventually.
Damn, that happened to me this week.
Yeah, well, thank God it didn't.
Yeah.
He had dual American and British nationality, and he was in the hotel management business. So for a period of time, he was running a hotel in Bermuda, which he could do because he had British, unlike America, you actually have to have legal right to be there in order to work in Bermuda, duh.
Bermuda has its issues, but...
Well, yeah, it does. But, but anyway, one of the issues that Bermuda has is that they are a little island in the middle of an ocean, and humans would like this stuff called water, okay, to drink.
Well, what is their water supply there?
So here's
springs of some kind?
No, it's all desaled. And you have a tank, you have a cistern under your house, or in your backyard or whatever have you, and the truck shows up and dumps a load of water in.
Yeah,
there.
But Bermuda was there 50 years ago. They weren't desal then.
Oh yes, there was. In
the 40s.
Well, in the 40s, they were probably doing using steam distillation instead of membranes and such. But here's the thing. It's damned expensive. Okay. And so, now they also, I'm sure, collect rainwater. All right. I mean, it isn't like it doesn't rain there all the time. Well, yeah, it does. But there's only so much of that you can collect. All right. I mean, it's got to rain, right? But somehow, you have to have water that's drinkable, or you're not going to have any humans.
Did you know that in World War II, we, the U.S. of A., somehow ported an awful lot, virtually all women, allegedly of pretty fair looking women to Bermuda, and every piece of mail that went from the U.S. to Germany was opened and read.
Yep.
And the trick was to steam the letter open and put it back together so it didn't ever look like it was open.
So it didn't look like anybody tampered with it, right?
Because the thing of it was ink blots. everybody's looking for ink blots. Because
oh, I got you.
And yeah. The hard part about, and you know, you and Kevin know this more than most, the hardest part about sending a letter over like that, if you were a German spy, was in writing the letter to make it sound like it was a real letter.
And it wasn't whatever yeah, the
it wasn't
spy
like some
was.
some goofball thinking of something, like it was to your son or to your brother or right. your sweetheart or whatever, or the sweetheart writing it to the guy or that they had. They had, you know, hundreds of the. Now, how the hell did they get water then? This is 1942.
Well, you know, it's one of the things about that is that we've known that you can distill, you know, you can distill water, and by the way, if you don't have a huge energy source, which of course distillation requires, solar stills are a thing, but and they work, all right. However, the price per gallon of said water supply is pretty high. Now, I had a boat that I didn't have one on my boat because I didn't make extended enough. I had enough tankage to be able to carry what I would use between places that I would go into port. But a lot of people with sailboats and many larger vessels don't. And so they, you know, nowadays it's a reverse osmosis system that essentially, you know, the holes in the membrane are small enough that water molecules go through, but salt molecules do not. Problem with this is the pressure required, and therefore the amount of energy to drive the pump, is pretty extreme. All right, but that's how, you know, that's how water is desalinated today. You have to pre-filter it because obviously any kind of trash in there is going to clog up the, you know, up the unit really fast. So any kind of dirt or any, you know, any contamination at all has to be removed by pre-filters first. But that's, I mean, can you turn salty water into fresh? Yeah, you can. You're just not going to like the price. All right. And the idea that, oh, this is no big deal, we'll just set up a desal plant down here in, you know, in Texas on the coast. Okay. Oh, by the way, where are you going to get the energy to run the desal plant?
I know a little bit about this, Carl, for one reason. When we had a branch, PTI used to have a branch in Arizona, and the gentleman who ran it and his son-in-law, or actually his stepson, who's still with us, by the way, real nice guy, but the guy was, you know, he was up there when, you know, he'd be 100 now, but obviously he's not still alive, but his other job was in the ice business, in the water business.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, well, where do you get the spring water in Arizona? He goes, no, we use, what would you say, reverse osmosis.
Yeah.
We take the city water supply and essentially redo it for pure water.
Right.
And we make ice out of that. That's why the ice is actually much purer than you can make in your fridge.
Which by the way, if you're starting with city water to start with, you know, all the pre-filtering that you normally would have to do has been done.
Well, not as much in Arizona. He said in Chicago it would be a lot easier. But yeah. Arizona, the water's nowhere near as good.
Well, right,
yeah.
Sure.
And so, but the funny part is, remember when, I'm not going to show anybody's age, but remember when you were a kid, your parents, if they were having a cocktail party, they would actually send you out to buy a bag of ice, and the ice was the full, like, 2-inch cube that was perfectly, you could actually see through it and everything.
Yeah.
I said, how come nobody does that anymore? He goes, it's too expensive.
And
I
go, it costs too much money, right.
And I go, why? He goes, because you actually have to freeze it as a big block.
Right.
Because, you know, when you get a block ice, it's always clear, right?
Right.
And he says, then you have to saw it.
Right.
So when you saw it, you waste all the stuff. Even if you have the world's thinnest blade,
you
waste
still saw it. What, yeah,
you still waste all that. He goes, you don't want to waste it. He goes, yeah, that was the best ice ever made. That's right. Why people would always go out and buy it for a party instead of just using the stuff in their fridge, because the stuff in the fridge is always cloudy, right?
Right.
But yeah, but reverse osmosis was the key.
Yeah, you know, so I mean, that's, but that's the thing is that, I mean, if people seem to forget, as I've been, in fact, one of the things in Leverage in the book that widely published back after the crash, is that behind every unit of economic output is a unit of energy. There are no exceptions to this rule. It is a law. It's a natural law.
Whether it's a human doing something or something, there's energy.
It makes no difference.
Yep.
There's behind every unit of output of any kind is a unit of energy. and the only source, the ultimate source of all of that in this solar system is that screaming, flaming orange ball in the sky.
Oh yeah.
And that is fact, and it makes absolutely no difference whether you like it, don't like it, approve of it, don't approve of it, whatever. None of that matters. And all of this nonsense that's been going on for the last 20, 30 years is all about constraining that supply on artificial grounds without having a clean debate with the public as to the costs and benefits of making those decisions. And the people that are trying to do it are lying.
But Carol, this has kind of been, by the way, second and a half hour, I want to talk about where we're going with Hal's stuff the other day and where this is all going to end. I mean,
we're in trouble.
But, you know, I find a theme this week is, I'm appalled by this Apple crap this week. But then again,
crazy. Yeah.
But how many bitcoins of Trump's did he have to buy to get this deal?
Well, there's that question too.
Yeah, right? But what I'm saying is the Kevin was his usual articulate self, talking about how the details on the supply chain and details on manufacturing that it is sort of important. And I was talking to Bill Moriarty the other day on the show. I said my people. The people I'm stuck with, for lack of a better term, are Johnson, Pritzker, and Trump. It doesn't appear to me, even though I think Pritzker is supposed to be smart enough, but I don't see any one of those people able to think anything through. And all the stuff you're talking about, I mean, it's not like, I mean, I know I was lucky to go to grad school when I did. I mean, we paid for it, but I mean, I was lucky because that kind of thinking was what people were taught. Right. And you had classes where people would say, okay, and Milton Friedman's, the exam would be something like something out of Time magazine, and somebody would lob some policy change out there. And he would say, from a stock and flow analysis, analyze this all the way through the next 25 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Does anybody do that anymore? Does anybody say, wait a minute, if we do this, it might have this benefit, but then we used to have a class... And been one of the parts that was like 2 weeks. We went over 2 weeks, a long time in grad school, because I mean you're going pretty fast.
But
it was on executive compensation, putting bonus plans together to make the chief executive essentially do what you want him to do for the long term. Or
right,
and you put stuff together. And some the first one was back in those days it was they get a bonus on every quarterly earnings. That's not going to work. That's where you're going to see the guy pouring
that's
the crap.
That's not so smart, yeah. Right.
That's where you're going to see the guy pouring the pollution in the local stream, not caring 10 years from now if we have to clean it up.
Because, right.
But if we would actually, there's like 25 guys, people in class, and maybe 5-6 ladies, and somebody, they would pick somebody's out of the pile. You hoped it wouldn't be yours, and they'd start putting it on the blackboard. And everybody's going, look at this. If you do that, this will happen. If you do that, this. But it became kind of a mindset where everything you did, you'd say, okay, if I do this, if the dog poops in the yard, okay, fine, but I got to clean it up at some point. Right. There's always the next step. If I do this, then what happens? And I don't find our people in power at any level seemingly able to do that. They lob this crap out there without any thought of where it's going to look like a day, a month, six years, 20 years from now.
See if it's...
Yeah, and Tom, if I could jump in a thought on that, because this ties back to what Carl's opening thoughts, just about employees and how we treat them and how we motivate them. And that is that it's the same thing. It's that same inability to think it through. If you think of what turnover costs you, and it's one of these things. It's not a lot of people have access to a specific dollar amount, but if you were just to put, time and job on the x-axis and productivity on the y-axis, and start plotting an employee's progress, what's your productivity day one when you start a job? It's near zero.
Zero.
Zero, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's your productivity, you know, 2 weeks on the job? It's a little better. What is it 2 months on the job? What is it 2 years? Now, you get to a certain point where it's just, it's capped. You can't be any more productive than a certain amount, because there's maybe physical limitations there on what you can do. But the point is that every time you have somebody who is well down that curve and at a very high level of productivity, every time you drive one of those away, you're going to replace that person with somebody who is right at zero. And so if you want to treat your employees like crap, you're going to have a whole lot of them that are way down on the wrong side of the curve, and you're going to have a very, very expensive production process, and that's assuming that you can keep your staffing levels where they are. Now, that is basic critical thinking. It is not too hard, and yet we're talking about a CEO of a major multinational corporation who just doesn't get it.
No, he gets it because he doesn't have to. See, this is where the problem is. I had, you know, instances where I had to face the possibility that because of some of the stupid stuff that had gotten inured into people within my organization, that I was seriously thinking about firing an entire department.
Yeah, well, and I have those days too, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's times that, you know, maybe you got to do it, right? Well, guess what? I know what happens if I do that. First off, you know, can I go out and attract people to take those jobs? Well, sure. At what price? And by the way, the productivity is going to go down the toilet. Guess who gets to cover that in the meantime? That would be me.
It's you.
Oh, yeah. Right? That would be
many rough days for you.
That means there's going to be an awful lot of no sleep, you know, nights that come out of that, right? And it's going to suck. And that is the pushback factor, that if I can find some way to meet the business requirements without doing that, I will. because the penalty, if I have to do it, is personal. The problem with these guys is that not only is the penalty not personal, their compensation is still there.
Yeah.
Right? They got their stock package. And oh, by the way, you look at the kind of things like this, you know, the stuff that's been going on with NVIDIA and to a large extent Tesla. And, you know, even though Tesla lately, you know, is their price has been down some. But look at what the board of Tesla just did with Elon's compensation.
They essentially replaced all the stock options that he used up to buy X, right?
Yeah, $20 billion.
Yeah, it's a real number.
All right, I mean, excuse me. How about and the argument from the board is always the same.
Well, what's the board? I mean.
Well, but see, the argument's always the same, is that these aren't worth anything unless he grows the company.
We'll talk about this next week. Maybe we'll have Kevin and we'll talk, because he's big on this too. I think one of the single biggest issues in this country regarding corporations is the boards are supposed to be some kind of a buffer against humanity or something.
And they're useless.
They're supposed to be. Yeah, they're useless.
Well, they're not just useless, they're grift machines.
Yeah.
And I mean, I saw this stuff back, you know, when I was far enough in an organization to be impacted by it, but not far enough up at a direct, I wasn't a director, so I wasn't in a place where I could actually stop it, all right? But I was just underneath that level, so you know, guess who got bent over the table with the consequences?
Oh, yeah.
Right? And been in that kind of a role in corporate America before as well. And the stuff that goes on when especially when you're trying to bring what should be a extremely positive, I wouldn't quite call it revolutionary change to an entity, but you're bordering that area, right? The people that will grift off what they can for themselves and their little fiefdoms within that organization, especially if it's a large company, is unbelievable.
It's incredible. While we still have Kevin, I got an interesting.
And I still have one more comment for you too. So go ahead.
I had many of them. There was a guy who worked at Pullman by the name of Bob Johnson. Talk about a character. But he had been a 45-year Pullman guy, and he was a program manager and knew everything about railroad. He was a car knocker.
Employee number, probably number, you know, top five.
Oh, well, yeah, and he was, but he was a kind of a grumpy old guy. And when the current contract was going really lousy, and he kept admitting it, you know, telling people that it was way behind schedule and everything, they pretty much put him off the pasture. But he was on the Boston contract with me. So one day he says to me, he goes, "Tom, let me tell you, this is the world's crappiest company. It always has been the crappiest company." He said, "The day I started is sweeping the floor, the gate I came in on, they locked before I left, and I couldn't even get the hell out of here until I found some open gate like three blocks away from where I came in." He goes, "It was crappy on day one. It's still crappy." He goes, but get a load of this. "There are so many incredible people here. People like you, I would never meet you anywhere else. Look at the people out here. If you want a jockey, I can find you a jockey. You want a guy to play NFL ball? I can find you a guy to play NFL ball. And look at the stuff we put out the door here. When you say you're a piece of that railroad car, the thing is beautiful. You can't get people out of here. They love it, even though every one of them will say the company sucks." I mean, you can have that going for you, too. You know, I think.
You know, pride of workmanship goes a long way, whether it is the result of really good management or whether it's the result of exactly what you're describing. Pride of workmanship matters a lot to people who actually do go do the work. So I will support, you know, exactly what you're saying on that. I do want to throw out, though, because if you know, when Dan Janinas used to come on, and he would talk about some of the companies, they evaluated management. That, you know, that was what always, you know, drove Dan, and it's one of the things I always found really interesting about his segments. One of my favorite companies in this area is they're actually in Plymouth, Indiana, and it's
a great little town, by the way.
Yeah, most famous alumnus, Scott Skiles, but they make Itamco makes industrial gears, little ones, big ones, gigantic ones, you know, big turbines for airlines. Very successful company, but it's also a Plymouth company, and they're very innovative, and they do a lot of really great stuff with, you know, building power saving in their process so that they can actually produce cheaper. A very lean oriented company, and you go back to 2007 and 2008 with them, and I've had conversations with their senior management people, and this is not something you're going to get in the Chicago area, but in Plymouth, they said we had to react, we had to cut people's hours, we had to do a lot of things. To keep alive during that period, said, but we're senior management. We see all of our employees at Little League practice, at the grocery store, at church, at whatever. And he said, we live with these people. And so that made them very highly motivated to say, anything that happens in this company, we share the pain. And so if they were doing cuts for the regular employees, they'd cut hours before they would cut anybody, you know, before they'd make anybody unemployed. And they said, we took them too. And we made it obvious that we were taking them so that everybody understood that we're all in this together. This is a management style that will sustain. It's just unfortunate that too many will, don't understand that. And it's too easy to not understand it when you're in the Chicago area and you don't see anybody outside of work. You know, you don't see any of those production line employees. They're not part of your life in any other way. If I'm looking, again, if I'm trying to say, what's the model for companies that are going to thrive through difficult economic times, you know, I would put that on the list somehow, and it's not going to be everybody. And maybe Itamco, there's good people at the top. But maybe in Itamco's case, it's the accident of where they're located too. But it doesn't matter. It's, you know, if I'm trying to figure out who's going to be around 10 years from now, I'm looking at that as a factor and how they approach it and doing it. Another big employee here, Lippert, and I teach a lot of their people.
Kevin, where do they have a
Jason Lippert is so focused on trying to make it a better place to work. and it matters a lot.
Where is there feed for like mechanical engineers and stuff? Is it from Purdue in Indiana or just anywhere? I mean, or do they have
Notre Dame as well. They're very locked in with Notre Dame, and they work. You know, they do a lot of joint projects with them.
So where, by the way, this is my wacky mind again. This is the exact same conversation we had yesterday regarding people going to Congress, and at some point there's a spot where you get too big. Now, if these guys, I'll say, got a hair up their behind to buy four other places like them around the country, somewhere along the line, would you not care about the guy in Utah, or would you?
I just mentioned Lippert. They have 90 plants around the country. In fact, they have European plants. They have Canadians. Every once in a while, they'll have me do a Zoom course for them. Heck, we did one last summer, for all their European people. I had a professor who works for me, and he was up doing the class at 8 o'clock in the morning via Zoom. So they have the same commitment. Once you get somebody driving that way and thinking that way, they're going to apply it everywhere.
Right. So what happens? Boy, I don't want to. Because I've seen it happen here in Chicago. What happens, the dude, again, knock on whatever, the dude gets whacked by a bus tomorrow, all of a sudden somebody comes in and wants to buy the place, and his kids say, I just want the dough, I don't care, I'm not going to run this place. And
yeah, then it's going to change. You know, that you get your first generation of leadership, and that's often a very tight relationship with the employees. You get to the second generation, it's not as tight, but they're kind of engaged, and then you get to the point where you start to say, well, the next generation of leadership, well, we knew the original starters, but they start to get so removed. And you're right, in a lot of cases they just sell it off. And you know, I see that locally. Martin's Groceries was, you know, they're now getting in the process of being sold the second time, but that, you know, that was a local grocer that has been very popular. They're still good. You know, Wednesdays is 10% off for seniors, so that's the day I go, and it's always been a higher touch store than most grocery stores ever are, and very beloved. But when Spartan Nash bought them, you know, Spartan Nash has a wholesaling subsidiary, and you knew if people are going to start getting into remote grocery shopping, you can't have people running up and down the aisles to do picking all the time. It's not efficient. So you need a different distribution model, and so that's what Spartan Nash brought to the table. But now Spartan Nash is getting sold. So I don't know how that's going to change Martin's over the years, but it will, and that's because the original founding family just didn't want to stay in the business.
Well, it seems like it's real easy if we use Carl's money and we bought some massive company over in God knows where, Taiwan, to say, man, it looks to me like they got too many people. Why don't you cut 10% without even going over there? That's kind of easy to do when you don't actually know anybody, right?
Well, I was part of that from my banking days. I knew how that drill went. And, you know, sometimes you are going to cut with acquisitions, and I believe the most humane way is to just do it. You know, take care of the people, you know, do help out placement, do, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do, but kind of dragging it out until it becomes a screaming problem at you is just, that's foolish too. So there's always the realities of business. That's never going to go away, and you're going to have to manage your cost structure properly, but there are better ways and worse ways to do it. And always remember, if you're going to have to, you know, if you wind up cutting any kind of staff or anything like that, remember everybody else who is staying behind is watching what you're doing with those people as they leave. They're watching how you treat people, and they're making their notes, and that matters too. So you can't just say, okay, we cut loose all the dead weight, and then you turn around and you look at everybody else and go, okay, we're family.
Well, you also say you got to work twice as hard for the same money. You essentially cut everybody's pay.
Well, yeah, and in many cases, you know, that people just figure out that there's a lot of duplication, especially when you do an acquisition, and there is capacity to just absorb it. It's not always you have to work twice as hard, but it doesn't matter if you treat people like crap on the way out the door. Everybody else knows it, and
everybody else remembers, and you've totally undermined any trust that you would have with people.
Carl, what do you make Milton Friedman? I remember him saying one day, going, if I could find a way to clone for a month and just have two of me and put one of me in a closet, he said, I'd love to go through a study. He goes, I actually think that all the economies of scale, is once you reach a certain point, they start going the other way.
And well, that's absolutely true.
Right. But where would you put, I guess, I mean, I think the example, I don't know what was before they merged, but I think he would say like Bristol-Myers taking over Squibb or something. Right. Might actually be a downer in terms of efficiency instead of, where would you put that number? Or is it possible to even put a number in?
I think it depends on the organization. I don't think that there's a hard figure you can put it at. But one of the problems with any kind of abstraction is that abstraction is always overhead. Okay, and people seem to forget this. I mean, as a software designer and as a coder, I certainly don't. All right, as a coder that goes all the way back to doing it in assembly language, and where you were actually writing instructions that the machine directly executed. The difference.
Done that too. It's great fun, isn't it?
Well, when you screw up, it is.
I'm serious. It is fun.
Well, and when you screw up, the machine crashes too. Your program doesn't crash. The machine crashes.
Yep.
But the thing about it is that what you realize is that it takes this many this many cycles to just add two numbers together. But if I have to grab one of the operands to that thing from somewhere, it takes this many more cycles. Okay, why? Because I just abstracted the operation to some degree, right? Now, to some extent, that kind of a thing's necessary in any organization. And as organizations get larger, they become more compartmentalized, you add additional layers, sort of because you have to, right? I mean, when I started my internet outfit, it literally was in my closet. I was the only one, all right? Then, I need somebody to answer the phone while I've got my face in a computer rack, right? So, all right, so now I have an employee.
You grow by a step function, which is hard to do.
Well, now I need somebody who can answer the phone. I need an employee, right? So now I got an employee. I want to add an employee. By the way, that means that we need somewhere to put put this operation. So guess what? There's an office, right? I've still got my face in a computer, but now I've got customers that want to talk to somebody because they've got some kind of a problem, whether it's a billing question or, some technical thing, whatever. I guess I need a couple more employees, right? And that's how this stuff starts. But then at some point you say, all right, I've got an entire group of people. I got 10 people that are answering phones. Some of them are doing customer service. Some of them are doing technical support. Somebody needs to manage that, because guess what? There's only 24 hours in a day, and I still need to have my face in a computer, and I need to be running this thing at the top level, looking down over the top of it. So now you have a layer of management that gets added into there. And at some point, as you continue to do this kind of thing, you create a real problem. You used to have hiring managers and stuff like that. Then somehow some mental midget came up with this idea that we need to have this entire department called human resources. Well, I got news for you. Human resources is roughly equivalent these days to next Karen, right? You can't insult anybody. Oh my God, you're going to get written up. You're going to have to go in front of HR. You might get fired for that.
They have two main roles: keep the company out of court and keep benefit expenses low.
Yeah, and then
we can get to the human stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And the part of the problem with that is that all these things become cost centers. So one of the reasons I rail so much about the whole healthcare, health insurance kind of thing. Is that and I don't understand how politicians get away with this, and I don't understand how people are so damn.
They get away with it because they have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, Chief, I don't understand how people are so damned gullible on this, okay? There has never been a single instance where you can manage a cost problem by adding another layer on top of it. And that's what an insurance scheme is. It has never been true in the history of economics and the history of humanity. And yet that is always, I mean, you look at the tripe that's running around now that, oh my God, Trump is such an evil bastard because he's going to take away your health care if you're on Medicaid. Well, wait a minute. The last person who did this was Bill Clinton, okay, when you had to put in 20 hours of work. But in addition, he put a 2- and 5-year limit on all welfare, all federally funded welfare, 2 years at a given time and 5 years during your entire life, and that was it. Now, he actually had several people within his upper-level advisory group. I don't know if they were actually cabinet members or not, but they quit. And the reason they said they quit was, this is going to kill people. This is going to kill children. It's going to throw moms and kids in the street. Da-da. Even though the same protections that are in the current bill that was just signed, in other words, if you got young children at home, if you're disabled, it doesn't apply to you. All right? They were in the same thing that Bill Clinton did. Essentially the same process. Well, ProPublica, 15 years ago, wrote an article on the outcome of this. And they said, well, okay, for all the screaming that people did, the facts are welfare utilization went down and so did poverty. Now, if just welfare utilization went down but poverty went up, you could say, well, you know, that was mean-spirited and it screwed people. But that's not what happened. And so how can you possibly argue that that screwed people?
I could argue it very easily.
Some individual, I'm sure, did get screwed. Okay, but you don't make policy decisions.
We're talking 30 years ago, roughly. I'm going to say that from what I see in Chicago, and I see it a lot because I'm all over the damn place, the condition of the, I'll use the term underclass, is way worse than it was in the 90s. The idea that the people I see, even if they wanted to, having any kind of a job for 20 hours a week, plus there's nobody to hire.
Oh, the 110 million that are not in labor force couldn't be hired?
I'm saying there's nobody here to have that job. There's no jobs in the city. There's no place.
Well, okay. And how did you do that? You made the cost of having those people on payroll.
What I'm saying is
nobody will do it.
It's one thing. Is it the chicken or the egg? I mean, it's not like, the homeless guy says, yeah, I'm fed up. I don't mind working 20 hours a week. Where do I go? Well, there's no place. It's
okay.
These cities are in way worse shape than they ever were during the Clinton
time. Yeah, and guess what?
Well, okay, you can't just lob one out there that sounds good and say that, you know, is there a job for somebody? It's the same thing as Pritzker wanting to give everybody equine, whatever, if you've got Alzheimer's. Okay, how are you going to match up the horse with the kid? Where are the logistics of this? You got to walk.
Well, absolutely, Chief, but guess what? Pritzker and your mayor and the litany of people before, right, Lightfoot and everybody else, none of that has anything to do with the outrageous driving of cost to the point that nobody can afford those things out there?
There's two things that are I think for sure, even with the current people in Washington, two people that if somebody shows up bleeding somewhere, we're going to take care of them. I think that's America. Maybe it isn't anymore, but I think it is. Okay, now who the hell is going to pay for it? Now, are we going to do it in a way where we sew somebody up and we do it for a price that makes sense, that maybe we could actually afford? Or are we going to drop them into an emergency room? I read something, you guys were part of this because I read it to you guys. The first half hour in county or any place with a bullet wound, they had to do with the x-rays and then this person and that person and this blood test. We're up to, maybe you guys remember the number, was it 20 grand in like half hour or some absurd number? I'm sitting there, wait a minute. The doctors there. There's no variable cost there. The x-ray machine, unless you went out and bought a new one in the last 5 seconds, it's there. I mean, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a sponge, there's going to be sutures, they don't cost a lot. Where are we getting this?
I'll let you know, because I'll have an ER bill pretty soon. So.
Well, you know, you're in a sane area, I'm going to say. You know, so it might not be as bad as going like the Northwestern or someplace, but I mean, but it's insanity. And how much money does Northwestern make? What did they make last year? I heard that they don't even pay a water bill. What is that all about? Anyway, but so on one end of it, we're all fighting about what are the costs are, and I think on this show with you two guys, as much as you have a much better view of where these costs ought to be, and that used to be my job in the world. I don't know how I ended up in the cost accounting, pretty good at that. And these numbers don't make any sense to me, except the overhead rate. And what did Katie, when she was on talking about research at these hospitals, what did she say, Kevin? That the overhead rate that Northwest, if we gave $2 million for sickle cell anemia research and we did it at Northwestern, what did she say the overhead rate was? 3 or 4? Or some incredible, I mean, what the hell, over?
That crap is, you know what, that crap's all over academia, too.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
And it's ridiculous.
You know how many, you know what the...
Yeah. But if anything, you know, I work at a school where I see the overhead where it shouldn't be spent, but I also see what would normally be classified as overhead that we aren't doing because, well, maybe advisors are not overhead. Maybe advisors are really, should be considered, volume tied like faculty is. But, you know, nevertheless, again, you're making the very strong point that people who are running these things don't really understand what's going on there.
What would you guess? Maybe you don't want to say it, Kevin, but I looked once and I can't. I looked again to prove I was right the first time, but I think at the University of California places, what, they got 5 or 6 locations? Was it Berkeley?
Oh, yeah, they're out of control.
Well, I think it's 10 indirect for every direct. I mean, I'm going to guess...
I've been doing it for a while. I'd have to go through and say, how are they classifying direct and indirect? Because I just need to understand that, what their structure looks like. But nevertheless, I think you're right. I'm not going to go get myself fired or anything, although, you know, I can always hand out cards at Walmart sooner than I planned. The thing to understand is, and I bitch about this all the time, and I've done it in other businesses. I've done it, you know, even in my banking days, that sometimes you cost yourselves a lot of money saving money, and it's just because you're trying to save money in the wrong places.
Well, I would guess you guys are 2 to 1, maybe.
Yeah, but where I'm going with it is I'm saying, I may not need as much money spent on student life activities, but I sure as hell need good advising so that we keep people, we keep people on track to graduate on time without wasting a lot of time for courses they don't need to graduate and so on. And the better we move people through that pipeline, the more efficient we are, the more we're going to get tuition money. So if you look at a revenue stream, it is really built around, it should be built around being efficient. And so when we say, well, we can't afford that, here's where we're going to cut this, here's where we're going to cut that, because the governor just, the legislature just gave us a lot of cost cuts. And so when you start saying, well, okay, how am I going to do this? I look at some of the areas and say, don't cut there. That's going to rev up our revenue engine. And because we won't staff classes unless we have enough to cover the professor's cost, we need that revenue engine working. And instead, that they're just going to throw it back on faculty and say, okay, faculty, you have to help us, do a better job with retention. Well, my job is to teach great classes, and that helps with retention. I shouldn't have this other job that says I have to be calling students to make sure they get registered. That's where I'm going with it, and it's an example. But if you take that same example and apply it to the business world, you got all kinds of businesses operating the same way. And as Carl laid out, you know, you start to get the bloat by saying, well, I need one of these. Now I need another of these. Now, okay, well, who's going to manage these people? And, it's every once in a while you have to step back and say, okay, how did I get here?
Well, Carl, I mentioned the we talk a lot in grad school about the step function. I mean, you're gonna if you get to 10 employees, maybe it's a little light. You're gonna hire somebody to handle employee matters. I won't call it a human resources department, but now that person probably is good up to 25 employees. Hopefully they can do something else as well at that stage, because it's not your HR person, for lack of a better term. It's not full time for your place. It's more than you can spend part time, but it's also not full time. Right. You know, so you end up, I mean, growing businesses, as you've learned, and you know, PTI is pretty hard. That person better be willing to help on the phones or something in addition to doing.
That's one of the things that happens is that you get in this box where it's like, well, there's 24 hours in a day, and the people that are currently doing the work, you can't take any more from what they're doing to do this other function without severely impacting the whole reason that they're there, including you.
Yeah.
All right. And so, I mean, that's what drives that acquisition, especially as, you know, as the organization starts to expand horizontally. The problem with it is, and where you have to be really careful, and what we've done a terrible job of when it comes to accountability, it's even worse in anything that is indirectly funded, like a government, like a university that can go at federal funding streams and things like this, school systems. You take a look at what you've got going on in Chicago with regards to the public schools, and you have a shrinking enrollment because people have left the city, all right?
And you have charter schools that people go to.
Well, you have charter schools, but you always had private schools. You always had, somebody wanted to send their kid to Catholic school, right? So you always had that. But the thing is that as the product has become less and less valuable as seen by the person consuming it, which is the parents of the kids, right?
Yeah.
They vote either directly with their wallet, even though they still live there, as they say, screw this, we're moving out to Naperville, all right? Or we're going up on the North Shore, we'll deal with Nutria, even though,
You can go to Evergreen Park, you don't have to go that far, Oak Lawn.
You just have to leave that environment. But then what is the reaction of the Pritzkers and the mayors and all these other, you got your governor, you got your mayors, you got the teachers' unions, you got all these other places. Oh, you have to keep this building open even though there's 10 students in it on a given day. Well, wait a minute. On the basis of what?
Okay? Well, you have...
Because let me tell you something. If I had, if we had a shift in the demographics and in the penetration of our services, and all of a sudden I've got a facility that's out there that I'm paying for power and water and the computer racks and, the equipment, and I got to have a guy go out there and check them, even if it's a remote facility. Somebody's got to make the rounds to the place and make sure that, that everything's okay and staying within limits and all this. But there's 10 customers on that thing, and there were 500
we got a dash, but let's kick this up on Tuesday, because there's kind of more to that than meets the eye in some areas, and you know this. It's sort of like closing down a Catholic church, which has happened on the South Side. You're not just closing down the church. You're writing off the neighborhood.
You know what? So I'm supposed to subsidize all the people.
What I'm saying is destroyed
the product.
It's a discussion. If you talk about a school on the south side that's been there forever, and it services the square mile around it, and all of a sudden you got five houses left there in the square mile, and you say, all right, let's demolish the school. Are you giving up on the square mile forever? Nobody's ever going to live there? Or what are you doing? You're right on cost. I'm not going to debate you on that. But in terms of the message and what you're doing, should we find a way to get some people living there, for God's sake? I mean, maybe that's the problem.
Find some way to monetize the school in a way that,
First of all,
when government does that, they tend to choose to compete with the private sector, which is not appropriate.
I'm with you guys on all this stuff. All I'm saying is there's a little bit difference of a message there. Are we going to tear down the remaining houses and make it into a park or a golf course? You know, if we do that in some of the areas, it's probably not a bad idea. But I'm saying there's more to this thought process than just, we don't have enough kids, let's tear the place down. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, but nobody wants to address, why don't we have the kids?
Well, I get that. And
by the way, in the 1990s, when I tried to hire the product of these systems, 80+% could not do basic four function, but Carol, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division on a piece of paper.
The school that my brother graduated from, that I played basketball in the Quonset Hut four nights a week for 20 years, as we played there in the St. Bernadette's, it closed. Okay, so now it merged not with the parish next to it, but they jumped over a parish because the parish next to it's full. So my first question was, okay, do the kids that are going to Catholic school that used to be St. Bernadette, do they walk to that spot, which is the center of what that parish used to be?
Right.
Do they hop a bus and take the bus 2 miles to the other place? Or now all of a sudden does everybody have to get driven there? Does a fourth grader have to somehow get on?
There's all kinds of externalities.
Yeah, there's all kinds of externalities. On that's my whole point this week. Nobody ever thinks through them. It doesn't appear.
Of course not.
Well, we try to.
And they don't for sometimes for at least understandable reasons. So, you know, Carl talked about building his business. And, you know, as you add people on there, he still had to be involved. He still was doing coding. He was still in the racks. It's hard to come up for air and say, you know, let's look at the big picture there, until all of a sudden, you know, the big picture starts to just beat you over the head. And a lot of companies grow that way. It's inexcusable, though, to have a mature business, whether it be, you know, the school system, or just, you know, a business in any other industry, and not know better, because the people you supposedly who are in charge of that should be very well versed in the big picture. It's one thing for startups, because, you know, you learn the hard way sometimes going through the process of growing a startup.
Well,
it's
sure.
Very, very different for everything else.
But it's still your job.
We got a dash. S&P futures are up 11. Just as you guys know, my grammar school, St. John Fisher, which is still there. Boy, it's still walk by. Boy, talk about shades of deja vu. We had four classes in every grade. Irish people are good at some things. And so we had 32 classes, two kindergarten, that's 34 teachers. There was a principal and an assistant, a music teacher, and two janitors. And if somebody called in sick because they were on their deathbed, the principal taught class that day. That was an overhead of what? Five divided by 34.
Yeah,
doesn't get any lower than that, does it?
Yeah, the Archdiocese schools were always very good at that. Hey, thanks for letting me hang around the extra hour. The conversation was interesting, so I hope you don't mind me jumping in.
Kevin, the fact that you couldn't talk for 2 days, I knew you had stuff to say.
There you go.
It was percolating out. It needed to come out. Thank you. SB Futures up
a little. There was a lot that needed to come out,
we won't talk about that. SB Futures up 12. NASDAQ Futures up 37. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.